desert. I want this country to realize that we stand on the edge of oblivion.
I want every man, woman, and child to understand how close we are to chaos.
Can't get no sleep.
Hello and welcome to this edition of Alternatives to Thought. I am Chalmer Wren and I'm joined by my normal co-host. We have Norman Schultz.
Good morning. And that intro just always cracks me up.
Yeah, it's great. We have to keep it for sentimental sake.
Apparently
sentimental
we do.
Sake. We have Nick Arcus.
Good morning, everyone.
And we're here with Brittany Rose now.
Hi, y'all.
And today we are here to talk about the group psychology of religion, specifically the Muslim religion, given the relevance in the media lately. We are joined here with special guest Morgan Levy. Say hi, Morgan.
Hello.
It's nice to have you. Morgan is a retired neuropsychiatrist whose area of expertise was brain behavior relationships in people with dementia illnesses such as Alzheimer's disease, frontotemporal dementia, and stroke. And he is here to join us. Essentially, we have two questions in mind that we want to answer with this particular podcast. Is the Islamic religion fundamentally different from any other major religion? And are Muslims fundamentally different human beings than any other large group of human beings? And I think our thesis for the episode is no.
Well, so one of those questions, I think, is worded unfortunately, because to say that the Muslims are fundamentally different human beings, I mean, that would be a weird thing to say. I mean,
but yeah,
they're the same species. So,
well, that is, in fact, kind of the point.
Right.
We're talking about the group psychology, right, is that there's nothing different about people of the Muslim faith. We're talking about a common psychology, a common basis of the human condition.
Yeah, I mean, if they were a tiny cult
of thinking, yeah,
you know, of 1,000 people, then I might think maybe they somehow group together by psychosis. But the numbers of Muslims, that's
the same. The cult of wayward sociopaths,
right?
You know, unfortunately, we do have an environment right now that fosters that type of thought that they are different, and that is something that's unfortunate but real with some people.
That's strange.
It is. Yeah. It is strange. I'm not saying it's not bizarre, but unfortunately we have a lot of people that think that they are different. And that's honestly racism in its most fundamental.
Yeah, that's exactly correct. In this room, you know, on the bell curve of how your brain works, we're sort of on the left side. And so we're not like, there's nobody that's sort of on the Tea Party side that's in this room right now.
Right.
But mm-hmm. there's plenty of them.
They make the podcast pretty fun.
Well, I have lots of friends from Texas that are in the Tea Party, and I converse with them all the time. And believe me, if you shot out what you just said about they aren't fundamentally different, they would argue you tooth and nail.
Well, and I think we would be talking past each other.
Right.
I think we could get to what we really need to talk about, which is not that are they fundamentally different as are they fundamentally different from birth. This would be a version of the nature-nurture debate.
No. They would be of the opinion that they are fundamentally different human beings.
From birth.
Yes.
That would be racism. That's weird because Islam is not a race, so that's a highly confused position.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, but they are us, or they are them, and we are us. Us is good, them is bad.
Well, I think I'd probably be
so that. Yeah,
I think it's a hard idea for us to go. Oh, that makes sense because none of us think along those lines. But I think we have to accept that some people just ignore reality and ignore the biological facts.
It's more than
of
some
life.
People. So we
yeah,
look
but
at
it. Really is half.
But
the
wait
country.
A second. Wait a second. I mean, if football fans do this too. They hate like. What are the Broncos fans? Who is their arch enemy?
No
is the Oakland Raiders or something like that? Yeah. So
a Raider hater.
I don't think that if you talk to a Broncos fan, they would say that people who are Oakland Raiders fans are born different than them. They just are in a different spot for whatever reason. I think that probably that's what people mean most of the time when they are anti-Muslim, like they're categorically different. They don't mean that they're different from birth. They just mean that they've become different from the things that they have been brainwashed in or whatever. Is that fair to say?
That's exactly correct. I'm glad you bring up the football analogy because, you know, I'm a huge football fan and I frequently make the football analogy when I'm talking about how our brains are programmed because football is very much similar to how we lived when we were hunters and gatherers, you know, out on the savannah in Africa, right? So if you think about how our brains are programmed, think about how a football team functions. You know, that's really what we're programmed to do. That's why we love watching it so much.
Right.
I mean, from a logical point of view, if you were a completely different species and you came and saw us enjoying football, you would go, geez, why in the heck would they like a weird sport like that? You know, because
I must be a different species.
I was about to say the same thing. I find it difficult to enjoy football. Well, yeah. But, I mean, there have been a few times the skill of the throw and the catch and the strategy and all that, but the barbarism and the team like fervor I've never got.
Well, most humans' brains.
It's normal. It's American pastime. Yeah. This is why we can't understand the reindeer games. They don't make sense to us.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, you have to have exposure to it, and whatever it is that you have. I mean, if you, I probably could name whatever it is that you guys are interested in that is organized in a similar way. I mean, it's the way we organize things. We organize into small groups. You know, we trust our in group. We distrust the out group.
Right.
That's just sort of how we function, right?
Well, and that certainly makes sense. Like I've never been into football, but over the last couple of years, I've been watching football with a group of friends, and so I've gotten into it. But when they're not around, or they're not available, or somebody cancels, don't care. So to me, it very much is part of a group psychology. It's only exciting when it's shared or it's encouraged or it's part of that group psychology.
But the point is your brain can easily understand it. And you can feel emotions because your team is fighting another team, right? Mm-hmm. And that's kind of how we're programmed, right?
I actively avoid that, by the way, in everything. Because even if I'm talking to some, the strongest pull for me would be if I were talking to a Republican, conservative Republican, and I actively avoid just prejudging them and thinking that they're on a different team. And I try to find commonalities, and one of them for me, my wife and I, we have some rental houses, and we kind of agree with the basic sentiment of. We are taxed enough. So we understand that that mentality of, there are too many taxes, you got to draw the line somewhere. So I can find something to relate to them, and I try not to just judge them.
But you do understand that on the huge bell curve of brain function, you are way over here in the 0.0001%, right?
I wouldn't even say brain function. I would say that you are conscientious of a psychological motivation, and because you're aware of it, you control it. I would say most people would like to say on paper, oh, yeah, I don't judge people. I feel like that's a good thing. Most people feel that way about themselves. Mm-hmm. Because the actual judging process is a psychological mechanism that they're not necessarily aware of. It's rationalized. It's justified. It's somewhat innate. Am I right in that?
Yeah.
Well, we fight instincts every single day.
Yeah,
we are violent, judgmental, base lizard mind. We're fighting that every single day.
You guys are totally right, actually. And now that I think about it, back when I was a Jehovah's Witness, I judged everybody who was not a Jehovah's Witness. Who was not a Jehovah's Witness was the enemy, basically.
Well, and when I drive down I-25, I'm judging everyone. And I'm fighting that instinct to destroy everyone.
Well, that's different. I'm with you on that one.
that's justified, Brittany. That doesn't count.
I've never hated anyone more than the guy who cut me off this morning.
Oh, yeah.
Sorry.
I hope he burns in Muslim hell.
Yeah. Oh no! No virgins for you.
Yeah. No.
Well, so I like the way this conversation is going. I guess what we really want to talk about is what is different about Muslim, because it seems like there is something different about maybe not Muslims, but the extremist. There's something different about the mentality of someone who, in the United States decides to hoard weapons at the threat of the federal government coming and knocking on their door,
right?
And kind of thing.
So there's two questions. The first question is, is the Muslim religion as a religion fundamentally different than any other of the major religions like Judaism and Christianity, etc.?
Right.
And then secondarily, are people who are Muslims or Arabs or live in that part of the world or whatever, are they fundamentally different human beings than we are here in America?
Right.
And in order to discuss this, we have to do something that humans don't do very well, and that is we have to talk about stuff on a large scale.
Right.
Human brains are sort of focused for small groups of about 20 to 150. They like small numbers, and they like things that have to do with relationships and those and you know, being a part of a team, and that those types of things are what our brains are programmed to understand really well.
Right.
When you start talking about nuclear physics or numbers that are greater than 100, you know, you sort of lose a lot of people in the conversation. And,
sure.
And so we're going to lose people in this conversation because we're going to be talking about really big numbers. Like,
right.
There's 1.2 billion Muslims on the planet. That people have a hard time wrapping their brains around that notion, right? And there's, you know, 300 million people in America, right? So if you talk about that large numbers of people, okay, 300 million people in America versus 300 million people in the Middle East, these two groups of people are essentially no different, right? Now you could,
if you just take them at random,
right? Okay. Now you can find 100 people in America and compare them to 100 people in Saudi Arabia, and you would have two very different,
wildly
groups,
different,
right?
Sure,
yeah, yeah, yeah. But if you're talking big numbers, there's no difference, right? So, are people that are crazed fundamentalist idiots in America?
Right.
Of course.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right? Yes. There are some living in Arvada.
My sister, for example.
Oh, no. Oh, shout out.
We're not pulling any punches on this one. We're going to offend.
Laura and I were
strangers, family.
Laura and I were got politically active a few years ago locally, and I don't know if you know about some of the local history with one of our representatives, Pat, co-sponsoring a bill that reduced the number of bullets you could have in magazines.
You know about that
whole thing. And so we actually were out in the streets with signs on the opposite side of the with the street where people who are pro-gun advocates. Yeah. And, man, we really did see some nuts.
Yeah.
Like, painted the sides of their trucks in the Constitution. Like, this is – I'm not kidding.
Yeah.
And, you know, like the big flags waving and the smokestacks to intentionally pollute more. Right?
I wish,
you know,
I cared about anything
I
that
wonder
much.
If they actually read the Constitution
you would
on
think
the side
it,
of their truck.
You would think that as they were painting the side of the truck, they would actually have read it.
Right? Yeah, that's exactly.
Yeah.
Probably not.
So, yeah, I'm familiar, I think, a little bit with not being able to relate to someone.
So where are we
that's
going?
What you're talking
I don't know.
So,
this happens a lot.
Yeah, that's okay. So I think what this relates to for me, it seems on the level of psychology that we have a tendency to, like you were saying when before the show, to oversimplify concepts like the Constitution. It becomes sort of an icon in our psychology rather than something of context.
That's correct. You have to understand that we live in a world that we didn't evolve to live in. We evolved to live in small groups of hunters and gatherers that are basically at the top of the food chain, and the only competition is other small groups of hunters and gatherers, and there's limited resources, and you have and if you can't survive alone, you have to be a team, and you have to be kind of an egalitarian little team going around surviving, right? So that's how we evolved, but we're now living in these huge societies, right? Well, when we started, you know, being farmers and producing these huge societies that were all sedentary and living in one place. The old religions, the indigenous religions, had to change because a king had to rule 500,000 people,
right.
And you needed rules. You didn't have enough police to police everybody, so you needed some rules. So everybody, if everybody wasn't, you need rules to get people to stop doing what they were doing as hunters and gatherers and start doing stuff that would make it possible to have a large society.
Mm-hmm.
So the difference between indigenous religions and modern religions is that modern religions have a lot of rules, and we call them ethics and morals and stuff like that, right?
Right.
They're less concerned with the human, like emotive aspects of the human condition.
Right. All the rules are designed to get us to not do what we were naturally doing as hunters and gatherers. When we were hunters and gatherers, we didn't need any of those rules because what we were evolved to do worked perfectly. It was only when we became huge societies. I mean, imagine if we lived in Denver and every little group of 30 or 50 was fighting every other little group of 30 and 50, right? Right. We couldn't really live in this society, right?
Right.
And I mean, that's kind of how they're doing, you know, the Crips and the Bloods in Los Angeles, right? I mean, that's kind of what we evolved. That's how we evolved to behave, right? So we needed rules to make that not happen. So a part of modern religions is are all of these rules. Where was I going with this?
Well, we're talking about the difference that our brains are not evolved to live
right.
in this
so we,
new
yeah, right. So we
system.
Right, so we live, we've only been living in these large agrarian societies for at most 15,000 years, but more like more than 5 or 6,000 years for the larger
yeah.
societies. Right?
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
Basically recorded history.
Right.
From an evolutionary aspect, our species alone, it has 200,000 years of essentially nomadic small group.
Well, we left the trees about 6 million years yeah. ago, and really somewhere in the 4 to 5 million years ago, we developed complex language, we developed a much higher level of intimacy in our social relationships, we developed brains that had frontal lobes that grew way faster than you know evolution normally grows stuff because we had to deal with repeated climatic changes. Life out on the savannah was rough. It wasn't the nice little warm niche that was back in the woods in the tropics, right? Mm-hmm. We were out on the savannah, so when ice ages came and went, you know, we suffered. And so we evolved really fast. Then, about 200,000 or 300,000 years ago, we almost disappeared. We almost went extinct.
The bottleneck, yeah.
Right. And then after the bottleneck, there hasn't been much time since the bottleneck, and so that's why we are an unusually homogeneous species, mm-hmm. which mm-hmm. brings me to the point that when you ask the question, is 1.2 billion Muslims different from 1.2 billion Christians, fundamental, or 1.2 billion Arabs versus 1.2 billion Africans, or, you know, whatever group right. you wanted to name, is 1.2 billion humans, can they be different than 1.2 other group of humans? No, they're exactly the same. And the reason is, we are, as species go, we are unusually homogeneous.
Yeah, and the law of large numbers, too.
Yeah,
just
yeah.
Right. The people you're going to gather.
Right, and even if you look at humans that have been separated maximum amount of time. So, for example, if you went to Australia and you went found some Aborigines,
right.
and you went to, you know, England and found some people from Ireland,
right.
they've been separated about 50,000 years,
right.
which isn't enough time to have a lot of evolutionary change happen.
Right.
So even the brains of Aborigines and the brains of Irish aren't very different.
Right.
So the idea that, you know, Christians from Texas and Muslims from Saudi Arabia are fundamentally different human beings with different brains, that doesn't make sense.
Right. But yeah. I don't think that's what people mean.
Yeah, that's what people mean.
You think
yeah,
that
yeah.
it is?
Absolutely. Yeah,
you, that's you, how they you justified slavery. Yeah. That's how they justified yeah. a lot of mistreatment.
Have
of
you
the
been to the South?
Yeah.
I can't tell you how many times I've made the argument, but there's 1.2 billion Muslims. How right. can they be different? And yeah. gotten back, no, they're screwed up.
Yeah, but I gotta believe that this is a linguistic problem. Not they don't fundamentally mean that they're physically yeah, neurologically no,
yes,
different.
They fundamentally mean that they are evil, and we are not.
Yeah, and again, I think we're talking about a specific group of people. Some people, I think, would be willing to admit that the nature versus nurture thing. And nurture-wise, they're screwed up because their ideology is more poisonous than mine.
I think we
have this advantage as atheists to say that we can all agree that everyone's crazy.
Right.
You know, we're skeptics, so our list of things that we believe is very, very short. When we look at the number of beliefs that someone in a Muslim or a Christian or a Jewish faith has, their list of beliefs is much longer.
Yeah.
Right.
Their assumptions about reality go much broader than ours do. And so I think there would be two categories. We're talking about the fundamental racism where – and I do encounter this. I'm related to people who think this way. They do, in fact, think that on a physical genetic level that these are different kinds of people.
Well, okay, then maybe we should move this conversation past that because that is patently idiotic.
Yeah. I don't think anyone's going to argue with you on that.
Yeah.
It surprises me that anybody – I guess it doesn't – shouldn't surprise
yeah,
me.
No. Really?
But I think we should talk about the meteor subject, which is try to be a charitable person in interpreting when someone says they are very different. So let me give an analogy. As far as species-wise, physically, the workings of my brain, I don't think I'm different than Charles Manson.
No.
Or no, as an,
I,
as
I
an,
think
as
an, something it, happened at some point to an, make us different.
No, no, as an – if you compare two individuals, you can have a lot of difference.
Because people can be mentally ill. They can be born with defects.
Biochemistry varies from person to person.
Maybe I shouldn't use Charles Manson. I'll use Ted Bundy then, because I know he's... Ted Bundy was an educated, intelligent person. I think that fundamentally,
if we're talking,
the difference between him and any of us in this room is physiologically very minor.
Well, let's say that... I don't know where Ted Bundy came from. Let's say he came from Georgia. If you're talking about a million people from Georgia and a million people from Colorado, there's no difference. If you're talking about one individual from Georgia and one individual from Colorado, you can have, you know, a lot of difference.
That makes sense to me.
There's always more variance in a smaller group.
I understand that.
Yeah.
So,
looking at the law of averages.
Right.
But then again, physiologically, our skeletons are the same. Our brain structure is the same. You know, our eye structure is the same.
Well, physiologically.
So I'm trying to get at what does it mean when I say, because in a general context, I would not say Ted Bundy and I are the same. We're not. right? But on a physiological level, I could mean that. Yeah. And I understand what you're saying.
He's a member of my species. Right. So
it's not entirely accurate, but what do I mean when I say, we aren't the same.
You're talking about beliefs, right? Like it's a war of ideas. Like it just comes down to specific beliefs have specific consequences. I think Sam Harris says that a lot. And I think that that's what the root of all this is. What do they believe and what are the consequences of those beliefs?
And what are the possible psychological consequences of holding a set of beliefs?
Right.
Right. And so if you put in your mind the my friend from Texas A&M from the Corps of Cadets, who's now a cattle rancher in East Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And who's a huge Christian, who hugely believes in the U.S. military, and who is, you know, has all the Tea Party, you know, who wants Ted Cruz to be president, and, you know, if you put your mind into his mind,
mm-hmm.
and you understand when he tells you that these Muslims are evil people.
Right.
Right.
I'm going to try to be charitable and think that he's not thinking there are different species or physically different.
You
I'm going to be charitable.
Someone else thinks.
I know, but in order to make the conversation interesting, because the other view is stupid.
Linguistically, he wouldn't agree with you that they are different species, obviously.
Right.
But he would agree with you that they are fundamentally different human beings. In that, but he would talk in mystical terms, like they're evil and we're not, right?
Right.
Right. I think that that's actually one of the keys. I think a lot of people who are religious believe in an objective thing that is out there called evil.
Right.
That was the thing I said. We have an advantage as atheists in comparing all of these things. If you, at some level, if you're religious, you have to say that they are different, at least ideologically.
Right.
But when we talk about human psychology, we can all agree that we're subject to the same motives they are. That's one of the reasons we are skeptics, is because we're aware of some of those biases and we try to put them in check.
Right.
So when I say he has a small brain, I don't literally mean that his physical brain is small. And in fact, he has a very high IQ.
Right.
What I mean is he's thinking in small numbers.
Right.
Which is how humans are programmed to think. What he's thinking is, there's one or two or small or 50 or 100. There's a small number of Muslims who are over there marching people around in orange suits and beheading them and saying death to America. And he's saying those people are very different from me and my small group of people. That's what he's really saying.
Right.
But he is saying it in language to indicate that everybody in America is different from everybody in Saudi Arabia.
Right.
And so his
–
doesn't make sense.
Right.
But he can't think, you know, he isn't thinking in large. He's thinking in the small. And he's talking in the small.
It's a hasty generalization.
Right.
Generalization. Right. Sure.
He sees Islam as a single entity, whereas Islam is a huge – complex and multifactorial entity.
Sure.
I mean, there are more divisions within Islam than there are within Christianity.
Really?
There's like 5,000 different Christian sects, right? Mm-hmm. So you wouldn't think that somebody from the Westboro Baptist Church would represent Christianity if you were a Catholic, right?
Right.
But we don't see
Islam has more divisions?
It's highly divided.
That doesn't surprise me.
Yeah.
Well, it's a young religion. That's what always happens with younger religions.
Well, it's not that young. It's old enough of a religion to have splintered into a million pieces. But it's young enough to still be, kind of have a lot of let's not go there. But the point is that, you know, my friend who's the cattle rancher in East Texas,
right?
You have to get into his mind and understand, you know, that you can't hate him. He's actually thinking like a normal human being. If you're not thinking like him, you're not thinking like a normal human being. Right. Now, here's a bigger question. And, you know, if we're going to talk about, you know, people and their minds and how people are thinking and stuff, you have to be introspective. If you're not willing to be introspective, you know, so let's talk about Norm.
Okay.
I'm liking this podcast.
Yeah. First of all, is Norm fucked up? And if so, how is Norm fucked up?
Sure.
Okay.
This is going to be a two-parter, isn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. We're going to have a follow-up episode.
Yeah. So let's just assume, for the sake of argument, that the answer to question one is yes.
Okay.
So how is Norm fucked up?
Got it.
Okay.
I prepared a list.
Yeah.
Bear with me here.
If you actually dissect the brain and you look at brain function compared to brain anatomy and whatnot, and you look at the different parts of the brain, there's two places in the brain that are most recently evolved.
Okay.
One is the prefrontal cortex and one is the angular gyrus. The angular gyrus is a small part of the brain that is anatomically located between the occipital lobe, the temporal lobe, and the parietal lobe.
Okay.
The occipital and temporal and parietal lobe are lobes that take in sensory input.
Right.
For most species, sensory input isn't integrated. And one of the things that makes us unique is that we're able to integrate sensory input.
Hmm.
So, for example, you're able to hear a ball bouncing in the next room and get a visual mental image of what that ball looks like bouncing in the next room.
Got it.
It's weird to think about, but we're the only species that can do that.
Right.
Yeah.
And so because of that, to have that ability.
Really?
Yeah. And to have that ability really takes an enormous amount of brain function.
Yeah. Well, you think about it.
Wait a second. Don't you think that's incredible that we're the only species that can do that?
There's a lot of things that we're the only species that does this.
Yeah.
I'm the only species that makes tea.
Yeah.
But if you think about
that's your definition of tea.
If we're talking about this from a neurological perspective, and you think, well, how could an alligator do that? They don't have the anatomy, right? It's not there.
Right. I mean, if a dog heard a ball bouncing in the next room, he would hear the ball.
Right.
He would know something.
React to it.
He would know that there was something that was bouncing in the next room.
Right.
Right. And because he could tell from the sound that that's the sound that something that's bouncing makes.
Right.
But he would have no idea what it was that was bouncing until he went into the next room and visually saw it.
He can tell the difference in sounds. So, you know, dog owners can bounce one ball and that means one thing, and bounce another ball and that means another
thing.
That's
Pavlov's dog.
He can tell the difference. He can tell what is bouncing in the next room.
He just can't visualize the ball.
By all the auditory cues.
Right.
But he can't tell anything about what it looks like.
Can't synthesize a complete experience from a single sensory input.
Right. When I say synthesize, what I mean is understand something not in the way that it came into your brain.
Sure.
So if auditory information comes in, you can actually see it.
Right.
That's what we can do, right? So in order to do this, and here's the really fundamental thing that I'm trying to say is, in order to have this ability requires an enormous amount of computing capacity,
mm-hmm.
right? So it's like, you know, it's like you had a small Macintosh from 1981, you know, and
I bet I had that.
Yeah, and you wanted, you know, to do some of the crazy stuff you can do with computers on it this day, right? You needed a lot more memory, right?
Right.
And so our brains needed a lot more memory in order to be able to do this activity of integrating sensory perception.
Hmm.
And the first thing we needed to do was we needed to actually grow angular gyrus, which is a relatively small gyrus, but we needed to grow it in order to synthesize these sensory inputs, right?
What does the word gyrus mean?
If you know how when you look at, you know how they talk about if you took the cortex, you know, the part of your brain that actually thinks is actually a very thin part that's on the very surface of your brain.
Huh.
The entire rest of your brain is just axons, wires, right?
Right.
The thinking part is a very thin layer right on the surface of your brain. And you know how you've heard them say that if you like flattened your brain out, it would be the size of a tennis court?
Sure.
But your brain is actually crumpled up like a piece of paper to squeeze into your small court, to your small...
skull.
Skull, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, when you take a piece of paper and you crumple it up and you look at it from the outside, you know how you see a lot of twists and turns.
Right.
A twist is like it's called a gyri.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. And so different gyri have different functions.
It's a little cul-de-sac in our brain.
Right. Well, the cul-de-sacs or the spaces where there isn't brain are sulci.
Okay.
And the curved little parts that there is brain are gyri. So gyri and sulci, right?
I gotcha. Yeah.
Okay. So if you look at the human brain and you look at evolutionary which parts of the human brain are older, the older parts of the human brain are in the center, in the, like your limbic system and your brainstem.
Right.
As you get a little bit further out from that, you get more medium old. As you get to the cortex, you get the newer parts of the brain.
Right.
And then specifically, as you get to the angular gyri, which is in the back of the brain, and the prefrontal cortex, which is the front side of the brain, those two are the most recently evolved.
Mm.
So they have the least redundant circuitry.
Okay.
They're the most fragile in terms of function, right?
I got it.
So, for example, when you get Alzheimer's disease, these are the two parts of the brain that go first.
So, I thought your memory went.
Well, no, your limbic system... deep into the brain but that's a very specific location.
Right.
The limbic system where you lay down new memories.
Right.
That's heavily hit with the pathology in Alzheimer's disease. But in the cortex, the parts that go first are generally the angular gyrus and then the prefrontal cortex.
Huh.
In other words, I'm not talking about the fundamental pathology of Alzheimer's, but I'm just talking about, you know, how the course of Alzheimer's disease might last 5 or 10 or 20 years. And over the course, you know, how you slowly get worse and worse and worse and worse, right?
Sure.
So basically your entire brain ultimately is demented.
Right.
And by demented, I mean the cells in your brain that do thinking die and go away, right?
Right.
And that's a slow process that ultimately encompasses your whole brain.
Sounds awesome.
But the first parts that get encompassed are the newer parts, the most recently evolved parts, the parts that are most susceptible, that don't have as much redundant circuitry, right?
I see.
Yeah. And so that's what we're talking about with the angular gyrus and the prefrontal cortex are these locations, right?
Okay.
So angular gyrus does sensory integration.
Okay.
Prefrontal cortex... is what we use to plan, to organize, to do a lot of the things that when we talk about our species sort of being a higher species or a more educated species or a more thinking species, what we're talking about is the function of our prefrontal cortexes.
I gotcha.
And if you actually anatomically dissect the prefrontal cortex and you look at the cells, they are grown enormously. It's kind of like this really abnormal, huge amount of growth.
Right.
So, for example, if you look at a chimpanzee and you look at their prefrontal cortex and you compare it to ours, they have little tiny shriveled ones and we have these great big ones, right?
Right.
So it's kind of like our muscle is in our prefrontal cortex. You know, no other species has a prefrontal cortex. So you can't take some other species and like... You know, play with them in the lab and test their prefrontal cortex because they don't have one.
Right.
Like, we're the only species. Yeah. And let me correct myself. They have it. Other species of primates or of apes have prefrontal cortexes. They're just little tiny slivers compared to our great big ones. Right?
Huh. Yeah. Interesting.
So here's the point I'm trying to make, and I guess I kind of went
wrong. No, I can listen to this all. I can listen to this all day. I am really enjoying this.
But here's the point I'm trying to make is that earlier I was talking about generally how our brains are programmed to function in a small hunting and gathering society, and that my friend that's in East Texas, that's a cattle, you know, he's more thinking like a human than you are. Recently in evolution, some of us have developed a limited ability to actually think outside of our programming.
Hmm.
That activity is done in the prefrontal cortex.
Okay.
If you look at everybody that's alive today, you know, and it's really a small percentage that can really do this well,
mm-hmm.
a larger percentage that can kind of do it a little bit, but it also takes a lot of training to be able to do it. So, for example, if you had the ability to think a little bit outside of our programming and you went to college and you went to graduate school and you were a researcher for a long period of time and you put your research in front of other people where they criticize the hell out of it, you would learn how to think outside of our programming, think logically, think scientifically. You know, our species has only really been doing science for about 150 years.
Right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it's not something that we were programmed to do. It's not something that most of us really are able to do. And in the few of us that can do it still have to get really trained and try really hard to do it. I mean, mm-hmm. in my professional career as a scientist and a researcher, I was always thinking that I was very logical and scientific-minded, but I would frequently I wasn't thinking about that correctly.
All the time.
So it's a really hard thing for us to do. So let's say that your brain in the big bell curve of brain function is on the end of not being able to think in an abstract way, but being able to only think concretely,
right.
being able to only think literally, being paranoid, being full with the rest of the programming that goes into somebody who's a really good football player.
Right.
And if that's you, then, you know, sign up for ISIS. You're going to run with them and feel great. So does that kind of...
Mm-hmm. It kind of does, but this is an uncomfortable conclusion. What you're suggesting is that the vast majority of people would be sympathetic to the extremism that we're seeing.
No,
maybe predisposed to it.
No.
They could understand it.
No, your word "vast majority." What I'm trying to say is, okay, this is a little bit tricky.
Well, I think what I would say is that it's not just the vast. It's every psychologically normal person has the predisposition, the wiring to right. become. A football player or a member of ISIS or a moderate or a Republican.
Well, I have that wiring too.
Right.
Everybody in this room has that wiring. We just have additional wiring that kind of overrides it. Right.
But you have to remember that everything's on a bell curve, right?
Right.
So let's say that you are way out here on the bell curve.
Okay.
You know, you're like in the 0.001%, right?
Okay.
So you're one of the two or three people that like invented ISIS, right? Right.
We should talk about that.
You are fucked up.
Yeah. No. Oh no. I didn't mean that. I'm not talking about you. I'm now talking about all of the.
Want our listeners to be clear. Yeah. I am Norm Schultz, and I had nothing to do with the invention of ISIS. Yeah.
Okay. You're going to be on a watch list now. You're not going anywhere.
Probably not better.
What do you know, Morgan?
So, but this is essential to the point of why we misperceive what's going on in the Middle East.
Yeah.
So you have, look at the Westboro Baptist Church. There's only about 50 members of that church. And they're this radical Christian church. They believe in literal interpretation of the Bible. They believe in Armageddon.
Yeah.
You know, the war to end all wars.
Christian
right?
douchebaggery, basically.
Right.
The
official state religion in Saudi Arabia is a form of Islam that is exactly like the Christianity that the Westboro Baptist people believe.
Right.
It's a very – they believe in literal interpretation of the Quran. They believe in Armageddon. You know, ISIS's whole point right now is to attract everybody from the rest of the world to come to Syria so that they can have the war to end all wars. I mean, that's what this is all about, right?
Right.
Manifest destiny.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I have an aunt that died recently, and I mean – For the last 40 years, I've heard her say over and over and over about, end of times and the, and all
I have
stuff.
Those relatives too. Yeah. But I want to go slow,
so,
though.
So hold on just
a okay.
second. Let me make this point I'll forget what I'm talking about.
Gotcha.
So let's say that you're the guy, let's say you're one of the, in the Westboro Baptist Church, there's only 50 of them, right?
Right.
It's kind of hard for them to build a 30,000-man army.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So it's kind of hard to build an ISIS in a civilized country like America,
right?
You can have a small number of guys, and you can go out to Wyoming or to Utah and have some farm, you know, and you can, like, train for the Armageddon. But you're not going to have 30,000 people that are going to come and join your cause, right? You're not going to be – if you go to some churches and you do some bombings and stuff, you know, your brand of radicalism isn't going to catch on in America, right?
We're the same, though, why not?
Well, because we're civilized. We have a police force. We have the FBI, the CIA, the sheriff's department, the media.
We have mechanisms to save people from themselves.
We have a huge complex society.
It's like, you know, social mechanisms.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, we are way more civilized than they are in the Middle East. So I mean, for example, you know, this guy a few days ago in California and his wife, you know, that shot up this. This San Bernardino government workers' Christmas luncheon or whatever, you know, as soon as they did that, you had multiple levels of all different, you know, agencies. You had, you know, 20 police cars and FBI and SWAT and everybody. You know, if that happens in Yemen, you know,
nothing prevents them.
SWAT doesn't show up.
They just keep rolling. Yeah. Is what you're saying.
SWAT doesn't show up in Yemen, right?
Right. Yeah.
So we live in a fundamentally different type of society than they live in the Middle East, right?
Right.
So in the Middle East, let's say you're a Westboro Baptist wacko job, and something happens to create a socioeconomically disenfranchised group of former army men. Like we created in Iraq.
Right.
And now you have thousands and thousands of guys who are more than willing to join your cause, but they aren't necessarily quite as radical as you are, but you can now get people to join your cause, right?
I gotcha.
So let's look at Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia, which we propped up because we told them, We will militarily protect you, and we will keep your regime in charge of your country if you sell us oil.
Right.
We did that back in the 60s or 70s, right?
Right.
So we propped up the Saud, the House of Saud, the ruling family in Saudi Arabia. We propped them up over the last 40 years. But what we realized at the time, but we didn't think it was going to be such a big deal. They are like the Westboro Baptist Church.
Yeah.
They have a very fundamentalist, radical form of Islam.
Right.
So they not only made it the state religion in Saudi Arabia, but because they had much money from oil revenue, they spread it around the world.
Right.
Yeah, you know, funded and seeded.
Yeah. It's in Norway for crying out loud. You know?
Really? Wow,
I mean, you know, so it would be like if the Westboro Baptist Church lived on a piece of property that actually
Spit out diamonds.
That under this piece of property had one-third of the world's petroleum reserves, right? And now you have this huge religion that's all over the place that's basically fundamentalist, right?
Sure.
Now, you're only going to have a small percentage that are really radically warped fundamentalists that are willing to die for the cause or whatever, right?
Right.
But there's a larger number
that follow
that religion. Like, my sister follows one of those type of religions, but she's not going to go kill anybody.
Right.
But she believes all that stuff.
Right.
Right.
She might donate money.
Right. So, yeah. So she might pay, she might support, she might donate money. She'll go, you know. But she's not going out killing people. So,
right.
So most of the people in Saudi Arabia that really worship and believe this really fundamentalist form of Islam aren't actively out trying to kill people,
right?
But they don't disagree with the fundamental values of the people who are out actively trying to kill people, right?
Right.
So they agree with ISIS in
the
terms
principles.
Of the basic parts of the religion, right? That, you know, if somebody's a homosexual, you should stone them to death, right? So
right.
They actually believe that. They're not actually out stoning homosexuals to death. But when other people that are more radical are, they're not like, you know, they're not like thinking, oh, they're doing the wrong thing. They're thinking, oh, they're doing the right thing, but maybe they probably shouldn't be going that far. You know,
sure.
You know, so the majority of people in Saudi Arabia are like that. Instead of, you know, so it just enables a situation where, you know, the lone radicals can kind of get a following and get some support, and you know, so you know, basically, if you look at ISIS, it's, you know, it's 30,000 man army.
Mm-hmm.
the core of which are former Ba'athist, you know, army men from Saddam Hussein's army, who were basically disenfranchised because their government became Shia rather than Sunni, and they got kind of caught between. And at the same time, you know, Assad's regime fell under an attempted revolt. So they got sort of caught between Syria and Iraq.
Right.
And these were guys who were, you know, who were out of a job and they couldn't work. And the unemployment rate's over 50%. And they were banned from doing anything in their society. And they all had great military training.
Yeah.
You know, so that's the core of ISIS.
Right.
You know, and so and they were all Sunnis, and the radical form of Islam that's in Saudi Arabia is Sunni, but it's the Sunni fundamentalists, right? So the Sunnis in Iraq and Syria didn't have any problem aligning themselves with the more fundamental
They
were halfway there already, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're like an Episcopalian and somebody comes over and says, "Join Westboro Baptist Church and we'll pay you a lot of money and you can like kill all the people that are screwing you,"
you'll be like, "Yeah, it's close enough to what
it's
I
close
believe.
Enough. Let's do it." Yeah.
This kind of seems like a survival mechanism. When you are, I mean, they were put in this position where, what now?
Right.
And so you have this group psychology where it's very easy to attach yourself to something with some momentum.
Yeah.
Because when you're isolated. We have that from an evolutionary standpoint. It makes sense. We have that urge to join into the group,
right?
Especially if there is no group.
Right. Choose the strong us, so then you can win over the weaker them.
Right. I have
a question. Do you think in some weird way that Islam suffers from not having a pope type of a figure?
from not having a what?
A pope.
Oh no, no. Actually, I wouldn't say. Yes and no.
Well, it's
definitely a double-sided sword.
Yeah. A couple of issues on that point. Excellent question. And this is something I think a lot of American Christians don't understand at all. Islam has no structural organization as an entire religion, right? Islam, the way it's structured is that your imam is your local priest.
Yeah.
Right? And he is the ultimate ruler of you and your local people.
Right.
And answers to no one. Right?
Right.
So everywhere where there's a small group of people, there's an imam. And everywhere where there's an imam, that imam can do whatever the hell he wants.
There's no over imam?
There's no king imam, right?
There's a lot of Protestant religions that are similar to this.
Now there are state, you know, there are places where the nation or the state, like in Saudi Arabia, has decided that on one particular brand of Islam, and they have like a, you know, an imam that is the imam for the entire nation of Saudi Arabia, and all of imams in Saudi Arabia are kind of under him.
Right.
But even in Saudi Arabia, you know, the head imam doesn't imam. It's kind of like in America, you know, how we have states' rights, you know, and federal government and stuff. I mean, you have a federal government, but you still have some states' rights, right? So that's how Islam is organized, right? And if you go all over the world, everywhere you go, there's a different imam who has a different version of Islam.
Sure.
That's why there's 5 million different versions of Islam.
Huh.
Now, the strength of this is that you don't have...
These are cells.
Yeah, Islam exists in cells all over the world. That's why it's such a variety of different, you know. That's why when we're talking about Islam, we're not talking about one thing.
And, so that relates to part of what's going on as well.
And there's nobody that can speak for all of Islam. I mean, if you're a Catholic, there's one guy that can speak for everybody.
That's what the Catholic
Church. Yeah, but that's
says.
Just the Catholics.
You can say that's what the Catholic Church.
But even a lot of Christians still, you know, say, "Oh, well, that's the Pope."
Yeah.
You know.
Right. So and that's kind of what I was getting at.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So if you look at is that good or bad, right? So think of
depends on the Pope.
Yeah. Think of if you're Catholic. Think of if you're Catholic, right?
Right.
Well, there are some good things about having a centralized power, right? The Catholics have been less divisive than the Protestants in terms of coming up with a million different crazy religions, right?
And but, this new pope is, you know...
And the new pope is a little bit better, but the problem with the pope is, you know, he's a dick. You know, so there's problems with having a single leader, and then there's advantage. So what are the problems and advantages of not having a pope, right? Well, there's opposite problem. The the good things are opposite and the bad things are opposite, right? So it's bad in a way to not have a pope, but it's good in a way not to have a pope. But bottom line, Islam doesn't have a pope.
Right.
So
Christianity is kind of more like the drones that are all centrally powered by the one spaceship.
Well, right. I would say Catholics, but when you talk about Protestants, I mean,
yeah, they're all over the place. Yeah. But the fact that Islam is so cellular, I think that probably does contribute to radicalization. It's not under anybody's control, so it's sympathetic to these kinds of extremists.
Remember when we were talking about large numbers versus small numbers? Mm-hmm. That if you had 1.2 billion people over here and 1.2 billion people over there, there's no difference.
Right.
But if you had 100 people here and 100 people over there,
there can be big differences.
Yeah, right. Sure. So if you're talking about your entire faith is based on 100 people here, 100 people there, 100, so you could get a very radical, you know, the Westboro Baptist Church has 50 people, and they're very radical.
Right. And we all know them.
Yeah. They're on CNN. They're in the news. They do anything and it makes national news.
I gotta believe though that there is, and I don't. I maybe this is not the right context for this conversation. Maybe we should have a follow up episode of someone who is extremely familiar with the Quran, because I even though I have not read the full Quran, I have read the full Bible quite a few times. Mm-hmm. And as much as I am against Christianity in all its forms for lots and lots of reasons, it does, as a book, I don't think it lends itself to extremism as much.
Oh, are you kidding
me? And here's
why.
No, let me explain why. Because the most common interpretation of the way the Bible works is that what is found in the Old Testament is outdated. And, of course, there are logical problems with saying that that was ever justified. But the Christian follows the New Testament. And there's not a lot of barbarism in the New Testament.
Oh, yes, there is.
What are you referring to? Because I know there's some bad stuff, but there's not a lot of barbarism in it.
Have you ever read Revelations?
Of course.
Yeah, well, it's a lot of bad stuff that's supposed to be happening.
But it's not telling people to do it. It's a story about stuff that happens.
I can kind of see that.
Okay. It doesn't tell Christians, look, when this happens, you need to go out and kill your next door neighbor.
Okay.
Nowhere does it do that.
Neither does the Quran. And here's the point. Here's the point I'm going to make, okay? If you read the entire Bible, Old Testament and New Testament, clearly, there's a lot of more horror stories in the Old Testament than the New Testament, but still.
Well, commands to do and terrible things. Right, there's not. What I'm saying is that there's not a lot of commands in the New Testament.
Yeah, there's less in the New Testament.
About the douchiest thing I can think of that is an outright command in the New Testament would be the treatment of women.
Here's the point I'm trying to make is when when I got the idea, after 9/11, that I needed to learn more about Islam and I needed to read the Quran and I needed to educate myself on this stuff. I got about halfway into doing that, and I realized two things. Islam is about 15 billion different religions that all believe different stuff.
Right.
And everybody sees in Islam whatever the hell they want to see in Islam, right? And about halfway into studying it, I realized, you know what? I don't need to be an expert on every little aspect of the Quran and Islam. I am an expert on human nature and the way our brains work and the way that and I'm very familiar with Christians, the wide range of Christian behavior humans who are Christian and how they behave in regards to religion. And so here's my fundamental point, okay? All texts like the Old Testament, the New Testament, and the Quran are these hugely complex documents with all kinds of stuff in them. And everybody that reads them through their own goggles, and it's like they're like Rorschachs.
Of course.
Whatever you want to see in them is in them, right? Well,
this makes a lot of sense to me, because earlier we were talking about extremism being born from sort of the disenfranchised. Mm-hmm. You look around the world, you look at gangs in L.A., you look at even in history, you look at wars, you see extremism being born from areas of poverty, from disenfranchised, from people without nations, from people isolated from their groups. and it happens everywhere. So there are extreme forms of Buddhism, extreme forms of Christianity.
Yeah, but hang on. Well, not in the numbers that we're seeing.
Yeah, well, you're talking actually two issues, right? What you're talking about is areas where there's fertile breeding ground to get a larger number of people involved in your radical movement, right?
Right.
But the radical thinking itself comes, I think, from individuals whose brains are on the, you know, 0.01% of the bell curve, who think very paranoid, who think very concretely and literally, and who, you know, who for whatever reason become somebody who's espousing, you know, like the head priest at Westboro Baptist Church, you know. People like that, you know, aren't very common. And but they're very, very radical. And like the guy who, you know, Abby Bobby or whatever that started ISIS, you know, from, you know, those kind of guys.
You just made that up, Morgan, right?
I can't.
You just came up with a Muslim-sounding name.
No, I've read his name a thousand times.
One more Muhammad.
I've read his name a thousand times, and I just can never say it, right?
Yeah. Abby Bobby?
Yeah.
We'll go with it.
My son came up to me yesterday and says, what's the difference between my son came up to me yesterday and said, Dad, what's the difference between Baghdad and Yabba Dabba Doo? And I said, well...
Pronunciation is one, but go ahead.
He goes, well, you're never going to see Baghdad on the Flintstones.
Oh, no.
Well, and I guess that's kind of my point, is that these religious ideologies, it's not about the details. It's not that the theology in and of itself is necessarily extreme or more extreme or less extreme.
It's humans.
Whatever is available kind of serves the psychology of the environment.
Right. So if you're 1.2 billion Americans or whatever, 300 million, let's say if you're 300 million Americans and you put us all on a bell curve, there are going to be a few individuals who have characteristics in their way their brain processes that information that are going to lend them to having these really radical forms of religion and follow it, right?
Sure. Yeah.
Exactly the same as if you're in Saudi Arabia. Same small percentage that are, their brains are like that, right? If you're talking about a large enough number of people. The question is, in which location is there a pool of other individuals that can be recruited to be a 30,000-man army?
Yeah, but hang on. Mm-hmm. I want to be very clear about what I'm proposing. For one thing, I think that obviously the Quran and the Bible and most of the other holy books are open to wide interpretations. Let's set that aside. And let's also set aside that there are going to be some people who interpret them wildly different, like completely – okay.
Right.
But taking away those – I'll call them outliers – I don't know the Quran as well, but the Bible does have a central theme. And the theme is all this stuff that happens so that the Messiah can come and change everything. Mm-hmm. And I think that the majority of people who are familiar with the Bible believe in that basic theme. Mm-hmm. So the others, I'm going to call them outliers. If you take that as a basic way of interpreting the Bible, a fundamental way, I still think there's... are lots of variations that can spread from that.
Right.
But if you accept that basic theme, I don't think you're as prone to radicalization because the New Testament... I'd like to finish there.
Okay, go ahead.
Because the New Testament is not as violent.
Yeah.
It is just not as violent as the Old Testament.
Okay, let me put it this way.
I can't believe I'm sticking up for Christians like this. It's not my intention. But I guess, so Nick agrees with me. I guess I just feel like if you put the – so, okay, there's part of this is circumstances, which you've explained very eloquently, and I can completely agree with that. But I guess I still believe that if you changed nothing about all of those people's circumstances except the book, that you would have less radicalization. Not none, but less.
I think that that's the truth, it seems to be. Look at – I think that Islam has a problem because they have martyr – the idea of a martyr in it. That's a problem.
And I don't think that the Quran has a theme that any one place is outdated. I don't think they have that common theme. I think you're kind of supposed to take it piecemeal.
Right.
And so that's my point I believe it's more prone to extremism.
Okay, so let me try to make your argument on a larger scale and see if you agree with it.
Okay.
Fundamentally, the Islamic religion is a fundamentally different thing than the Christian religion.
I don't know if I would say that.
But you just said that.
I think I would say that the Quran is a fundamentally different book than the Bible.
Then they don't contain fundamentally the exact same ideas. Some ideas are different, and those ideas can have consequences.
Well, then that's what I would say. Why don't you just argue, all right, Spanish Inquisition, essentially the same environment as now for Islamic religion. The exact same atrocities happened.
Exactly.
Then turn around, go to America not that long ago in Salem. Mm-hmm. Fundamentally, same situation as Islam. Happens. They did exactly the same thing that Islam is doing right now.
The reason we're not doing those things now is because we have developed our society to be a lot more civilized, and so it keeps a lot of that stuff in check. But any religion that is all over the globe is necessarily a religion of conquerors.
Right.
And that religion, those conquerors justified their conquering through their religion. You know, most of the people, all the people that conquered South America and Central America and North America justified the reason we were conquering these native people and putting in our religion is because we're a lot better than they are and our religion is a lot better than theirs is and we're going to conquer them and we're going to do it our way. You know, so, you know, Christianity has been the reason that millions and millions and millions of people on this planet have been put to death over a long period of time. So you can't argue that Christians don't do, you know, what ISIS is trying to accomplish, right?
Isn't there a fundamental difference between that time period in history and now? Because that time period in history was ruled very much from the top down.
That's my point.
That's how it is.
But that's not what we're seeing in the Muslim world.
No, that's my point. What I'm saying is the civilizing process is a process that takes a long time to happen, and and things have to happen for it to keep on track, right? So, for example, if you look at the world, right, and all over the world, the civilizing process, it gets started here, then it stops, then it gets started over here, then it stops, and it goes here, then it goes there, then it, you know, it goes back and forth, right? So if you look at the Arabic world, they were really, you know, well, first you had Greek, and then you had Latin, then you had Arabia, and these were the first kind of starting points of starting to become civilized, right? Then Arabia stopped being civilized, but then Western Europe became civilized, and America became civilized. And so we're like way ahead of them in the civilizing process.
Right.
If you go to the Middle East, they're 100 years behind us in the civilizing process.
Right.
And so in my opinion, as the West versus the Islamic world, in terms of the World War III, as the Pope said, that we're currently in now, what we really need to be trying to do, rather than going over and kicking their ass here or there, the thing we need to do is facilitating that entire part of the world in coming online with this new era of
being
civilized.
Convincing me. I still think there is a slight difference between the way the two books can be used.
Yes,
When I think of the Crusades, I think of kind of the phenomenon of what happened with the Nazis, that in reality what was going on with the Crusades is there was a very small number of people who were motivating this and everybody else who did it was following orders.
That's
not what is going on in the Muslim world.
But well, I think it's more applicable to compare them to the Spanish Inquisition because they're doing a lot of things to their own people because of the religion and the fundamental beliefs that they have. And that's exactly what happened in the Spanish Inquisition. And we're not even at that point comparing American and Islam. We're comparing...
I guess I just feel that there's more choice now. That the people back then, you know, somebody who was, the executioner who was operating the machine to tear the guy's intestines out slowly was doing it probably, I believe from history, was not doing it because he wanted to. He was doing it because if he didn't, somebody else was going to kill him.
They also have very limited choices over there. I've met someone who is Persian, was put in jail because he was a journalist and he was atheist. And he was put in jail for that.
Right.
So I think we have to appreciate the fact that they have fewer structures.
I think there's some truth to what you're saying, yeah.
And yes, we have a lot of choices now. That's why we choose not to rip out people's intestines.
Right.
And that's why we have police to say that we cannot rip out people's intestines.
Right.
They don't have those social structures.
Right.
And they have a huge amount of pressure to be fundamentalists from their families, from their religious leaders, from the government.
From the fact that they're disenfranchised and they're attaching themselves to a group for survival.
Yeah, and they're going, hey, fuck it. Yeah, I'm going to repel this guy's intestines.
I think I'm willing to say that the differences between the books is not the main factor in causing this. So I think you've convinced me enough for practical purposes.
I don't want to convince you too much because it's not like – this isn't a thing where like – There's only two ways to look at it.
Sure.
And you were looking at it wrong, and now you're looking at it right.
There are no two
ways. Not as right as I initially am presenting.
No. Everything you said is true and accurate on a small scale.
Right.
It's when you get to a large scale, it becomes less accurate. Huh. Does that make sense?
It does. So think of it, doesn't it at the same time.
let me make an analogy to so you can think about it.
My more angular easily. Gyrus is swimming.
Right. let me put it in language the human brain can understand. We're storytellers, right? And so we like stories, right? So here's a story. All right. Let's say as an analogy that you live in Hollywood and you're a filmmaker. Okay. What you do is you make movies, right?
Okay.
Can you just make anything you want to make and people will pay to see it?
Oh. Right.
No. There's about, you know.
Context.
Yeah. I mean, there's like
something with superheroes.
Yeah. I mean, you can take every movie that's ever been made and there's like 7 or 10 or 24 or 6 or whatever different ways that you can actually make a movie that people will actually pay to see, right?
Right.
So there's documentaries, you know, there's action movies.
The French, they're totally on their own.
Yeah. Well, so there's different.
Stand with France, man. Right. Stand with France.
There's different categories of movies, right?
Right.
But every movie, in order to be popular, you know, it has to have something that grabs your attention at the start of the movie.
The protagonist
then,
and
yeah,
the
then there has to be a story. Then there has to be a climax.
Right.
Then there has to be a resolution. Then,
right.
You know, so. I mean,
it's all very sexual.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's like I was watching this movie yesterday, you know, and
action climax. Yeah.
And this movie looked like something completely unnormal in terms of the way they normally make movies. And I thought the evil guy was going to be this really evil genius who was doing something completely different. And then the movie ended the way all movies end, and the hero won, and the bad guy got killed, and you know,
right.
You never see the bad guy win, right? Mm. Okay, so I'm a movie maker. Well, and
setting aside Empire Strikes Back.
Well, he ultimately didn't win, but he ultimately became good. Remember that?
Yeah. So. You can never set aside the Empire.
Then he died. Yeah, then he died. He was blown up.
So, my train of thought.
Themes that you have to draw.
Okay, so you're a movie maker, Architects. Right? And you're making movies, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you can make you can make movies that in detail maybe appear quite different. Like, you know, you can make, you can just name two movies and they're probably, you know, a wide variety of, you know, Cinderella versus
Die Hard,
right. And those are completely different movies, right?
Right. Not entirely.
But they're very, you know, it has to last at least an hour, not more than 3 hours. It has to have a climax. It has to have some resolution. It has to have something to grab your attention in the middle. You know, there has to be a relationship. There has to be, you know, I mean, structurally, there's things that have to be in this movie in order for it to sell and people to want to watch it, right? So I can't just make any movie I want. I have to make a movie that's consistent with how human brains are programmed, because human brains are programmed to see a certain type of story be told.
Right.
Right.
Hey, if I can jump in here real quick, guys. Yeah. The kind of movie I have to make right now is about me getting ready for work, so I might have to bow a little early.
All right, Nick.
Are we overtime?
No, we're not.
Okay.
We just got a little bit of a late start.
Okay. Yeah. So, so let's say, you know, so taking this movie-making analogy, right?
Mm-hmm.
So let's now talk about world large religions, not indigenous religions, but large religions like Buddhism, Christianity, Hinduism, Islam, Judaism.
Right.
Okay? I'll leave you guys to talk about that. I'm going to jump off. Okay.
Okay.
Okay, gotcha. Bye, Nick.
Thank you very much, guys. Nick.
Yep. So these religions aren't all identical, and in detail and on a small scale, there's a lot of differences. Right.
Similar themes.
But yeah, they. I mean, they all wear robes. They all cut their hair in the same way. They all wear, you know.
They all believe that there's something fundamentally wrong with the world, and they're the ones who have earned the right.
They all have a funny hat. If the head of your religion doesn't have a funny hat, you're not a proper religion.
I get your point.
Some religions believe that
it's falling apart.
You know, some religions believe that we should have all of the saints and we should worship all the saints. Other religions believe we should just worship one God and not.
What about Sam Harris's point that you're not going to find like extremist Jains, like terrorist Jains? You're just not likely to find them.
How many Jains are there in the world?
Oh.
Fair, yeah, it goes back to that 100 versus 1 point billion.
Right.
It's been a long time since somebody made me rethink some of this stuff. I really appreciate you joining us.
And when you take a small portion, when your sample size isn't big enough, you can always see that.
You can always find small religions.
This is messing with my head.
Good.
Yeah. You can always find it. You can always find a small religion that has a small number of people in it that are doing things that are like really good or really bad or really in the middle. But you can't find a 1.2 billion member religion.
How many Buddhists are there?
There's a lot of Buddhists.
Yeah, there's.
It doesn't seem to me like that billion. You're likely to. I mean, you know, there are some extremist Buddhists, but they're not. It doesn't seem to me that that's a religion that's likely to generate suicide bombers.
Well, do you remember?
What about the guy that set himself on fire?
Yeah, that's one dude, and that's not this. He didn't try to kill other people. He
was
just trying to make a point.
100 people. Yeah. As opposed to one dude.
No, that's not. We're not on that anymore.
How familiar are you with Chinese history?
Yeah.
Well, tell me. I'm not that familiar.
Do you remember the Teapot Dome scandal? Or the Teapot Dome war?
I'm somewhat familiar with this, yeah.
Yeah, it was
do tell.
Hundreds of thousands, or I don't know how many it was. Maybe a few hundred, maybe a thousand or two, or I don't know. Anyway, there were all these Buddhist guys, and they strongly believed that Western bullets couldn't penetrate their bodies.
Right.
So they charged, and we shot them all.
Right.
Well, and then I think there's also
Is that radicalization? I don't think that is.
Well, I'm not talking necessarily about radicalization. I'm just talking about having stupid ideas and going to war and being mean and trying to kill people and stuff. So the Teapot Dome scandal may not be perfectly a good example of what I'm trying to talk about. But the point being that, if you talk about China and you talk about the Buddhists, the Buddhists, we think of as pacifists.
Right.
But there were things that were created out of Buddhism that were not passive, were exactly the opposite of pacifism.
Sure.
Like, what's the other religion in China besides Buddhism?
Hindu, right?
Yeah. So all the people that didn't like all the free-floating liberalism in pacifism, they decided to have a more concrete, with tons of rules type of religion, so they made that religion, right?
Sure.
So, I mean... all I'm saying is let me just back up, get much bigger picture, and just acknowledge that some of the details I just said you could argue with or might not be exactly correct.
Okay.
But big picture, right? if you take millions of people and how their brains work and how they view religion, and we're looking at religions that are large agrarian religions with. That have rules.
Sure.
These religions were all created essentially by human brains.
Right.
And earlier in this discussion, we were discussing the idea that at one point in time, there was a bottleneck, and after the bottleneck, we didn't have a huge diversity in our genetic genome.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a relatively short period of time ago on an evolutionary scale, that the most separated in time of any people on the planet is maybe 50,000 years, which isn't enough time for our brains to have grown tremendously different, right? So we kind of made the assumption that even though there's 7 billion of us, we aren't really that varied on a large scale in regards to how our brains work.
Right.
And the ones that created all of these religions, were, unless you believe that there really is a real God somewhere, or that some of the 55 billion religions on the planet, that one religion has exactly a storyline that's true and accurate, and there really is some sort of supernatural being or force, unless you truly believe that, you have to accept that all religions were made up by human brains.
Right.
And all human brains are pretty homogeneous.
Right.
There's not a lot of variability as a species goes. So to suggest that their religion is fundamentally different than our religion...
Mm.
I
gotcha.
See what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So then you... furthermore, if you understand that most religions are ink blots and people see in them what they want to see, and then you take people on far ends of the bell curve... who are going to twist the religion the way they want, the way they see it with their goggles,
So even if there is some truth to the nature of the Quran being more violent than others, that being debatable one way or the other, I think what you're saying, and I think I can agree with it, is that it's missing the point. The other differences are way more important. And what I'm taking from this is the real differences are training, mental training, education, basically, and having a civilization.
Yeah, and now I want to go back and say exactly the opposite and support what you were originally saying.
Uh-huh.
You were right, right? On a small scale, everything you were saying was exactly right.
Right.
On a small scale...
The Quran is more abusable as a book?
Yeah, if you look at major world religions, right? First, there was Zoro... what is it called?
Zoroastrian.
Mm-hmm. The Zoroastrians, which is basically what Christianity is based on.
Right.
And then there was the Jews and the Muslims. And so...
You had a weird Babylonian like thing going on for a while.
Well, I'm talking about the big ones. The larger scale.
Gotcha.
More, you know... the religions of empires that were conquering.
I'm not talking about fetishizing cats.
Right. So, So the Zoroastrians were sort of mystical and more, you know, into sacrifice, personal sacrifice, and that sort of, like the Christians, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas the Jews and the Islams are more...
People from Boulder.
Yeah. Right, exactly. Whereas the Jews and the Muslims are more into having 536 rules that you have to follow,
yeah,
and structure, and,
yeah,
and every aspect of your life has to be structured.
That's your Highlands Ranch.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you can touch this part of your body, but not that part.
Exactly. So same kind of thing with the Buddhists and the Hindus. And if you look all over the world where there have been these large religions, there's always one that's kind of more liberal and one that's kind of more conservative. And that's kind of keeping with, you know, you can kind of, anywhere you go, there's people who are more comfortable with less structure and people who need more structure. And, you know,
Isn't this in the Greeks too, with Apollo and Dionysus or something like that?
Well,
like,
that was the advantage of having multiple gods,
yeah,
is there's a god for every type of personality.
Yeah. Cafeteria style.
That's a good point. So different religions may serve different psychological mechanisms, but you look at China, your example with Buddhism, we see in the history of Asia, you have all these same things. You have genocides, you have wars.
Exactly.
You have the disenfranchised. Japanese. It may have not been Buddhism that fueled a lot of that, but you had Shintoism or you had communism. So
right.
It seems like when you put people in that position sociologically, they synthesize something, mm-hmm, an ideology, and serve it to that basic function.
That's exactly correct.
I think the world does think that suicide bombers are a slightly different animal.
Right.
We can wrap our heads around someone who has a cause, as errant as it is, and wants to kill other people in the name of that cause. But killing yourself in the process, there's two things about that. One is it's much more difficult to defend against that fundamentally, mm-hmm, because you're dealing with someone who doesn't care about their own safety. There's a whole set of parameters around someone who is caring for their own safety that makes them easier to detect, right? And then second of all, it just seems really bizarre that someone would believe something so much that not only are they willing to kill other people, they're willing to kill themselves in the process.
Yeah. What about seppuku, though?
Huh?
Seppuku. Japanese seppuku.
Yeah.
And that's
I'm not saying there are no other examples.
I'm just saying, but that's a Buddhist thing. And they were usually samurais who were Buddhists. And they were Japanese.
So,
and they were talking about Asians.
So you're the topic area that you're breaching at this point is a whole nother category of stuff to throw into the mix of this discussion.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But this is the stuff that I actually am an expert on.
Huh. Mm-hmm.
Psychiatry.
Right.
Yeah.
One of the problems is that, you know, if you look at the other apes and you look at us, and you go back 6 million years and you try to determine how much evolution has occurred in the different species, right?
Right.
Well, compared to, you know, orangutans who haven't really evolved that much in 6 million years, we have taken off in a completely different direction over the last six. We've evolved a lot over the last 6 million years, right?
Right.
When a species evolves a lot, it it lends itself towards becoming extinct, like all the other homos did. Right? Huh. Not homosexuals, but
right.
Homo.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Erectus Australopithecus. Right.
You bring your species in the direction of becoming extinct.
Right.
If you have to evolve too fast, because you then parts of your body are, you know, aren't functional. Yeah. You know, basically, your body
you become a niche.
You become weird. Your body becomes weird and has all these leftover things from evolution. And because evolution, as evolution changes, it can't like start over from scratch. Mm-hmm. It has to kind of build on what was already there, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So if you're changing really fast, you're going to end up with a body that's kind of, you know, dysfunctional in lots of ways, right? Like
sure.
It's like it's why we have so much autoimmune illness and back problems and, you know, and birthing difficulties.
Sure.
You know, it's because
taping a bunch of like kitchen appliances to a car.
So we evolve too fast. So the same things are with I can say the same thing 10 to the thousandths when it comes to the brain.
Right.
Our brains evolved too fast over the last 6 million years.
Huh.
I mean, look at all of the other brains of all the other apes. They're half the size of our brains. Our brains have grown. Our brains have doubled or tripled in the last 6 million years. That's way too fast. And so our brains are susceptible to fucking up.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, you really look at our nation and you say, you know, what is our health? What is our biggest healthcare problem? Our biggest healthcare problem is mental illness. You know, it's a very small number of diseases, but it's most of the people in our country suffer from them.
Right.
I mean, it's, you know, depression, huge numbers of people.
Sure.
You know, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, you know, all of the, you know, anxiety conditions. You
like, know. I know someone with each of these things.
Right.
Yeah.
So, yeah, who doesn't?
At least one person.
Who doesn't? Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. And we don't, you know, it's not as profitable to become a psychiatrist as it is to become a surgeon. So, you know, we have a real lack of ability to get proper mental health treatment, you know, to everybody. And that's why we, you know, so basically throwing into all of this discussion about ISIS and radicals and how do you, are they different than us and all that kind of, thrown into all of this is mental illness, right? So your point of, you know, when you're talking about 1.2 billion, well, if we look at us versus them, they have exactly the same percentages of people with all of these different psychiatric illnesses.
Right. And they have nothing reining them in.
Right. But, so, you know, in even things that occur really in small and in low percentage, like a super paranoid, rigid individual that wants to kill people, you know, that's a very small number of people, but it's the same number here as it is over there.
Right.
But when you throw in the mental illness, you throw in kind of a wild card, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the mental illness creates stuff that you couldn't have predicted, like this incident that happened 2 or 3 days ago in Southern California, and nobody can figure out a motive, and it's the weirdest thing, and we're just like, a man and his wife, and they have a 6-year-old kid. They dropped off the kid at
I know. At it's like, oh my God, you've got to be kidding. You can't make this story up.
I know.
Yeah, it's bizarre.
Yeah, and you know, when I heard that story, and then they're in trying to figure it out. You know, they said, well, his father had some mental illness, right? And I'm like, there's some mental illness involved
here. Right. Right.
Yeah. You know? So I think we've pretty much answered the questions we set out to answer. So are Muslims fundamentally different human beings? I think we all agree. Not really.
No.
No.
And that's, in a way, a little bit scarier than the other answer. Yeah.
Yeah. Is the Islamic faith fundamentally different? Well, I think...
Not really.
Theologically true, but from a psychological perspective, from a sociological perspective, it's not relevant.
Not enough. Yeah. Not enough to make the difference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I think with that, we can close out the discussion.
Yeah, I'm going to be thinking about this for a while. I really appreciate you joining us.
Again, thank you for reappearing on the show. I think the content was as good as last time. We always make great content with you, so we appreciate you coming on.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Absolutely.
All right. I guess I'm going to take over Nick's line.
No.
Listeners, think responsibly.